You come in, you keep up the pretense, I've got it all together. And then you fall into a place of, I can't keep this hidden anymore. It's like this huge, oh my goodness, how can I tell people that I need help? And so I just want to create from the front of our congregation, like we all have stuff to work through. And so let's just be front forward about that so that we can actually take steps in authenticity towards healing.
All of us have tough questions we wish we could ask God sometimes. Life is hard and we wonder, does God know what I'm going through? Throughout history, God has said to his people, I see you, I know you, and I will make this right. This is a crucial message for women today as we so deeply need to rest in an all-knowing God who can handle what is happening in the world and in our lives. Releasing October 3rd, my new Bible study, Your God Knows, draws on scripture throughout the Old and New Testaments as I help answer six critical questions for our times. Am I forgotten? How does good come from bad? Do my desires and dreams matter? Am I generationally blessed or cursed? Will God make wrong things right? And will I be okay? This six-session interactive video-based companion to my book, God Knows, explores Nahum, a rarely studied collection of prophetic poems, to remind us that God is ever-present and always working, even when we feel alone or discouraged. If you want to know deep in your soul that a sovereign God understands your pain and will one day make all things new, get your group together or grab a copy of Your God Knows and study solo. I truly believe this study is for you. I'm too excited today. I'm excited to have on my dear friend, Ike Miller, pastor of Bright City Church in Durham, North Carolina, married to his co-pastor, also my dear friend, Sharon Hottie Miller, who's been on this show before. And though Ike has written before about the intersection of faith, mental health, and family of origin issues, he is a first-time author of new book, Good Baggage. Ike, welcome to Joe.
Well, Lisa, it is so good to be on here. I'm super excited as well. I've been looking forward to our conversation and just excited to be on here. So thanks for having me.
It's going to be fun. You know, it is always great to be chatting with someone who is a good friend wearing an old shoe, Ike. That's what it is.
Yep.
I'm so excited, though, to talk to you. So I don't know if men do this or if you do, to what degree. Maybe it's just a woman thing. But when you were picturing your life, when you were younger, or so when you're a young man, were you thinking three kids, pastor of a church, an author, or is this a not what you expected life?
So I think that, you know, the three kids, the pastor, those things are not, I think I envisioned a lot of that. I felt a call to ministry in early high school. And so I have kind of seen this as the track I would be on for a long time. You know, there's been times where you're like, maybe I'm going to do this, maybe I'm going to do that. But, you know, that's not the surprise. The two things that are the surprise are that we planted a church. There was no part of me that ever had any desire to plant a church. It was like the last on the list of ministry things that you can do that I wanted to do.
For good reason. God loves church planters.
Yes. But the beauty of that is on days where it's hard, I'm like, this was not my idea.
True.
Like this
was. Yeah.
So that, and then, you know, the author in some ways, I mean, I did not, you know, I think by the time I got to college, I was like, I would love to write a book kind of thing. But writing on this topic in particular is a surprise. I don't know that I anticipated the honesty, the vulnerability of it. It's probably not what I expected.
Yeah. You were writing like really heady material. Like all of your books were probably written in such a way that I would not be able to understand what you were actually even saying.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. This, you know, so I had my dissertation published as a book. I didn't feel the same tension of like, hey, as a pastor writing a book, this feels weird, because nobody in my congregation was like, I want to read your doctoral dissertation on pneumatology.
Exactly. Exactly. They weren't even reading that thing because nobody would even understand it anyway. It's a completely different animal. I was wondering about that. Do you feel a certain level of vulnerability when you're pastoring these folks and you're writing on a really vulnerable thing?
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't. And a part of that's because the vulnerability of this book really is a continuation of the vulnerability I've tried to have in our congregation, in my preaching, and in my conversations with our people. And a big part of that was just realizing If you want to impress people, you share your successes. If you want to impact people, you share, you know, your failures, your pain points, you know, those kinds of things. And so realizing, you know, I really wanted a community that felt more like, honestly, like AA than a country club where it's like you come in and it's like, hey, there's no pretense about why I'm here. I'm broken. I've got some stuff. I need help versus like, I'm going to come in making it look like I got it all together. And when you start from a place of, hey, I've got stuff I've got to work through, then it's not this huge, like, identity crushing thing when you need help. Whereas you come in, you keep up the pretense, I've got it all together. And then you fall into a place of, I can't keep this hidden anymore. It's like this huge, oh my goodness, how can I tell people that I need help? And so I just want to create from the front of our congregation, like we all have stuff to work through. And so let's just be front forward about that so that we can actually take steps in authenticity towards healing.
I think that's super important. I think it's really healthy and to the leader's benefit, because what happens when you do it the other way, as we've seen, and I think maybe even some people listening have experienced, is it is such a burden for you as a leader to have to keep up the shtick, to have to keep up some level of perfection that you know when you go home, you can't live that. It's really isolating. It's also, that's where a lot of shame, I think, lives, because you go home and you're like, it's a breeding ground for Satan to be able to come in and say, you know that you're not practicing what you preach. You know that you're not actually the guy or whatever. And honestly, I think one of the great things, we always talk about the good old days, and you always talk about the good old days when you get older. Yes. It doesn't matter who you are. You're always regarding. Listen, I tell my kids all the time, I'm like, you guys can dress like the 80s, but I lived in the 80s. So, hey, they're still mine. Yes. So, you know, we're always bringing it back. But one of the things that I think is actually better now than was when, like, my father was in pastoral leadership, is there is an acceptance of allowing your pastors to be more human, to take the sabbatical, to talk about things from the stage that, honestly, in his era, that was not accepted. No. And as a result, they crashed and burned hard. Now, if you crash and burn hard, hate to say it, but it's a little bit more on you because you have the opportunities that those guys didn't have. I don't know. I feel like there's such a healthy place there in what you're saying, and maybe encourage some leaders, young leaders that are listening, to start that way.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I found such a helpful image, and I talk about this in the book, is I love the image of David and Goliath when David goes to fight Goliath and Saul puts his armor on David. Mm. And David is kind of realizes, like, I'm not used to this. I can't walk around in this. And a part of that is because, you know, as far as we know, Saul was a pretty big guy. Mm-hmm. And so this armor just didn't fit him. And I think a lot of times when we, especially as pastors, find ourselves in a position where we feel like, okay, there's an image I'm supposed to keep up. There's an idea of me that I've got to put out there. It's kind of like putting on armor that doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And then we find ourselves in this position where there's this distance between kind of the armor that we're presenting, the image we're presenting, and who we actually are.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's been so just freeing for me is to see David had something I didn't have, which was, you know, if I were David, it would have been really hard for me to say, hey, I know all you guys have been fighting battles for a long time. You've been in wars, you're warriors, but I'm going to just set this armor aside. You'd be kind of like, okay, I know it doesn't fit, but you guys know better than I do. So I'm just going to try to do the way that you guys have done it. But he has a clear enough sense of himself to say, no, this is not how I fight my battles. And so he takes off the armor and, you know, defeats Goliath, when if he would have kept that armor on, it probably would have been to his detriment.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us as leaders keep on armor that doesn't fit and it ends up being to our detriment. Mm, so
that's a good word. So let's talk about this idea of good baggage. I think when people think of baggage, we always think an albatross, right? Dead weight. Whatever it is from your past is going to hold you back. And therefore, you're not going to be able to accomplish whatever it is you want. And so, you know, in casual conversation, if someone's difficult in a relationship, even we say, oh, she's got a lot of baggage. You know, I mean, that's the first thing that we always say. So yes. This idea of good baggage, when you told me about it a long time ago before this book ever came about, it's always been intriguing to me because I love turning things on their nose. You know, let's look at this. What about good baggage? So talk to me about where turning this idea on its head came from.
Yeah. So a little bit of the story really crystallized for me back during the pandemic when, you know, as a pastor, I was in a season where anybody that was in a position of leadership making decisions for other people, you were making decisions that regardless of what you decided, somebody was going to be upset.
Yeah.
Whether it was, you know, your masking policy, whether it was whether you talked about the election, whether you condemned this candidate or that candidate, whether you talked about race or not. And so I found myself in this position where I was constantly in lose-lose. I was constantly, someone was going to be upset with me. And eventually I became exhausted and just had to take some time away. And during that time, I was processing a lot of, why is this so hard for me? Why is it so hard when somebody disagrees with me, when somebody is upset with me? And I was thinking through some of the impact of my childhood. My father had an alcohol use disorder. My parents ended up divorced. And I knew that that had an impact on me. But when I crystallized, what I kind of focused in on this idea of codependency, I began to realize that my childhood was impacting me as a pastor and a leader now. Mm. And in particular, I came to understand that codependency was a way that we tried to manage others' emotions and reactions with our own words and actions. And as a child of someone who had an alcohol use disorder, you're always trying to figure out, how do I appease them? How do I keep them happy so that I'm safe, so that I'm emotionally safe, mentally safe, physically safe? And I realized that I had taken that and just transferred it to my whole congregation. Mm. I was trying to manage their emotions and reactions with my words and actions. And you know as well as I do, you just can't do that for everybody, much less one person.
Yeah.
And so I became aware of how my baggage was impacting my leadership negatively. But I also began to ask, you know, on the flip side of this, I do have this remarkable ability to read people really well. Mm. And as I dug into that, I realized, you know, just as much as there was the codependency, there's also this sense of, when I was a kid and I walked into a room, I was reading emotional cues. I was reading body language. I was reading eye movement and eye contact to determine, what's the emotional state of this room? Are things okay? Is this safe? And I realized that that was something that I had brought into adulthood, into relationships, that allowed me to empathize really well with people. It allowed me to be in a meeting and see when someone was in a space where, hey, we need to take a moment and just acknowledge what you're feeling right now. It's been a gift to me when it comes to counseling and counseling people. And so I began to say, you know, there are things from my childhood that make leadership and relationships difficult, but I think there's also some things from my childhood that actually prepared me for good leadership and good relationships if I can learn how to leverage them. Mm. And that was kind of the spark of the idea was, I wonder if there's more of this in there. I wonder if there's more of this good stuff in that baggage.
So, that is one of the things that I resonate so much with this. And you and I have talked about this before, but one of the reasons I love this so much and I love this book so much is because for me personally, my father was not, he didn't have an alcohol use disorder. It wasn't that. But because of how I grew up and we moved, I think 13 times by the time I was in the sixth grade, whether it be moved houses or moved actual states. I mean, that's a lot of moving because my father was very restless. And so he, there was a lot of things at play in our family. He was the central figure for everyone and everything revolved around whether he was doing well or whether he wasn't doing well. And it took me a long time to even be able to say that out loud. So everything was revolving around someone who we didn't even have a name for at the time. To this very day, you know, there were a lot of things that we didn't even discuss, as even with my siblings and with my mother, that we've been able to since he passed away, but that we're fairly convinced that even mentally he had going on and so forth. And so because of that, I became a super adaptable person. I would move and I would be able to adapt to relationships. I'm also can adapt to different environments, and I hold things very loosely, like material things like homes, which is amazing because then you really don't become very materialistic. And then yet, that's sometimes on the other side of that, you know, you become a person who doesn't attach well. And so there are the goods and the bads. But I think what you're saying is so powerful, because sometimes as you are trying to form identity growing up and all of these things, all that you see is the bad that has come from it, or you feel very clueless about who you even are. And so your identity is very confused, and you just begin to say, like, my whole past just a complete mess, and thus I'm a complete mess. And so I think what you're saying here is really powerful for a lot of people, even if, say, they didn't grow up with an alcoholic in their family, maybe that's the case, or something else at play. But even like me, maybe their life was very confusing. And so as a result, they adapted in a certain way, and they need to be able to see the good in that.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, people will ask if this book is for people that didn't have a difficult childhood or an outward, overtly dysfunctional family. And the fact of the matter is, any of us who have had any kind of relationship that had pain in it, which is all of us, right? Unless you've had just perfect relationships your entire life, we've all experienced some kind of rejection, some kind of dishonesty, some kind of disappointed expectations. And those things shape how we enter other relationships in our lives. And if we're not aware of how it shapes us, we're going to reenact the same things in other relationships. And so it really is work for all of us to do, because we're all shaped and impacted by the relationships we're part of.
Yeah, so good. I know that you were impacted by this idea, I think from another book it came from originally, but this idea of the cognitive life raft. Unpack that a little bit for the listener in the ways that you found particularly helpful.
Yeah. So the idea of the cognitive life raft is that you take the time to develop a clear understanding of what exactly happened to you in your childhood. And then using that understanding of what happened to you in your childhood to help you understand why you react to things the way that you do now as an adult, how that impacted you, how that shaped you, so that the things that you use to cope as a child don't interfere with your life and relationships now. So, for example, in my story, understanding that my father had an alcohol use disorder, and understanding that my dad wasn't just harsh, but at times was abusive, helped me to come to an understanding of why now, when I get around a person of authority, I may feel some intense fear. I may feel some sense of, like, have I proven my worthiness to be in your presence right now, or do I need to get lost? And so being able to understand that then allows me to say, okay, this is not the same context as my relationship with my dad. This person is not my dad, and therefore I don't need to carry that same sense into this environment and this space. And so one is just coming up with that understanding of what exactly happened and how do I carry that into other spaces. But then what that understanding does is it becomes kind of like a raft, and how as an adult, especially adults who had dysfunctional families, adult life can feel like floating in the open water. You're just out there and, like, waves are crashing, like life is happening, right? Throw on top of that these messages that you carry about yourself, that I have to prove my value everywhere I go, that unless I'm perfect, I'm worthless. Unless I just get it exactly right, I'm going to be punished. All of these messages that, on top of living in the open water, are pushing us down. And so what having this life raft does, this understanding, is then we can take those messages and say, you know, this message I'm carrying, it comes from having parents that had impossible expectations to meet. Let me take that off and throw that on those cognitive life raft, because that's where it belongs, not around my neck. I don't have to carry that anymore. That's not something I have to expect of myself anymore. And so we can take these messages off, throw them into that life raft, and it allows us to be a little bit lighter, to face the storms of life, the waves of life, with a little bit less weight on our shoulders.
You sound like a therapist right now, I have to tell you.
I've read a little bit.
I know you have. You've done some work. But when I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about how helpful this is in jobs, obviously, but also in marriages. Because so many times I think we respond to our spouse in a certain way. They trigger us in a certain way. I'm not afraid to say the word trigger, because I do think it is a great word. I mean, we are triggered by something they do. And in reality, it is a response to a reaction, either one really, to maybe the way that we grew up. And it's to our spouse, it feels like an overreaction. And it's kind of like, why is that such a big deal? And a lot of our behaviors, I think, are that way. You know, why are we the way we are? Why do we demand so much clarity from our spouse? Because maybe we grew up in a house where our parents were unclear. You know, maybe we never really understood the assignment. They assumed that we would know what to do, but they never really gave us great instructions. And so now we are so dogged about, you know, I want you to make clear what you're supposed to. I'm just using an example, but I'm thinking in real time. I think if we start thinking about the ways that we often respond to people, it is in fact because of the way that we didn't go well in our childhood.
Yeah. And there's a couple of pieces to that. One piece, I mean, for me, I have struggled with being very defensive with Sharon in our marriage. And as I was unpacking that, going layers down and realizing, you know, a part of that is in my childhood, if I had done something wrong, punishment was going to be swift and harsh. And so I needed to defend like why I should not get that kind of punishment. And so anytime responsibility was laid at my feet, you are defensive. And so I realized, man, I just carried that into my marriage where if I felt like you're saying I'm responsible for something, there's going to be punishment. There's going to be a cost to this. And so I need to defend versus being able to just, she's just trying to communicate something to me and help me to understand. The other piece of it is the relationships of our childhood actually form what I would call emotional processes or what are called emotional processes that create our patterns for relational engagement as adults. And so if we in our childhood had this consistent pattern of blame for something, defend for something, punish for something, that becomes a pattern that you will play out in your relationships as an adult, not because you want to or you think it's the right way, but because that is how you think this is supposed to go. That's how you saw it go, and that's how you think it's supposed to go. And so until we name that, it's going to be hard for us to change it.
Yeah, so true. You kind of touched on this a little bit before, but I want to land here for a minute. You're talking about the fact that when we're growing up, a lot of us in certain environments, maybe it's maybe it was a very volatile environment, right? And you just knew, okay, if I upset my father or upset my mother, this won't go well for the entire house, or this won't go well for me. And so we do what we did what we needed to do just to survive. Maybe we became the most compliant child in the house because that was a role that we realized very early on was going to have a great payoff for us. I was thinking about someone that I know, a woman that I know, that because her house was very chaotic, she became a complete neat freak. Because when her father was raging and he was on a binge, she would clean their house because she was, you know, she's young, she's a young girl. And so she realized, oh, one of the things that triggers my father when he is on a rage binge is when the house is in disarray. And so let me just clean the house and get it so spotless that there's no reason. I'm eliminating all the reasons for the rage, right? But as she aged, as she got older, then that became this thing that then she held over her children. And it's like, you have to be perfectionist in my house because now she's this perfectionist house cleaner. The things that were good in her past that she, you know, was used to survival mode, right? Now they've become really, really damaging in the way she's raised her kids. Exactly. How can we use them for the good now, or even kind of reverse what we're in?
Yeah. And that's so crucial is in that to be able to look back at our younger selves and rather than, you know, judging them or shaming them, really acknowledging and honoring the work our younger selves did to help us survive. I mean, you're exactly right. And as children, we don't have the ability to say, you're acting this way because you're under the influence of some substance or you're overstressed at work. We just know the house was dirty and you got mad, right? And so if the house can be clean, then you won't get mad, which is not true. Like there will be something else, right? But honoring the work that our younger selves did, but then being able to say that is a coping mechanism that is outgrown and it no longer serves the purpose for which it was created, for which it was started. And so that is something, though, that is really hard for us to see in ourselves. Yeah. I mean, nearly impossible for us to see in ourselves. And I think we can only begin to see it when we're willing to sit back and reflect on our interactions with others and to be able to say, okay, where did that interaction go sideways? Mm. When did I begin to be upset? And then be able to ask, why did I get upset? What led to my emotions getting out of control in that moment? What led to me feeling like I needed to put the pressure on them to clean the house, to be perfect? And then you get down a few layers and you say, okay, where does that need for everything to be perfectly clean come from? Well, it comes from that experience in my childhood where that's what I thought was going to keep my father happy. And you can finally get to the bottom of it. And that's when you can begin to do the work that I call disarming. You're disarming this switch that you didn't even know was there, but gets hit in times where you don't know that that's what's going on. And then you begin to say, okay, the next time I find myself in a situation where my inclination is to put the pressure of being perfect on someone, those are the moments that I've got to figure out, what does that feel like and how do I respond differently in the future? And so I kind of walk through that. I've got a whole process for that in the book where I talk through how the process of change works, how you begin to do that, why, you know, it's such a long process. And sometimes you have to make the same mistake many times and find yourself in the middle of like, here I am acting the way I don't want to act all over again.
Yeah.
But it's a part of the process. And ultimately what happens on the other side of that is, and what was so good for me is when I look at Jesus in scripture, I feel, I'm like, how does he have this level of peace? How does he have this level of ability to be calm, to be at peace in the midst of this moment? I want that. That's what I want in my internal world.
Yeah.
But we only get there when we understand, what are the things that set me off and send me into this place where I am somebody I don't want to be?
One really important thing that you share in the book is a moment when you're traveling out of town and you had committed not to drink alcohol. And then you go out of town and you go out with some friends and you have a drink and you talk to Sharon on the phone and Sharon asks you about it and you lie. And you talk about this idea in the book, lying for love. And it made me think about something I wrote about in Jesus Over Everything in a chapter about honesty over hiding, because I was talking about the idea of covering for people you love and thinking that it is loving them well, because you think, well, I love them. And so I'm going to cover for them. And a lot of folks do this and think, it's even spiritual to cover for people that we love. And I think I came face to face myself with a certain point that it is not spiritual to cover for people you love, to lie for love, as you call it in the book. Why do you think we mistake love for cover up when it comes to our families and relationships? And what do we do instead?
Yeah. So in that section, kind of what I'm talking about is there is what I call the cycle of sabotage. There's this cycle that sabotages our relationships. And it begins with codependency. I don't know who I am. And so I will be whoever I need to be in order to gain your approval. And so we do this process of approval seeking and we keep up appearances and images. But eventually, because it's just an appearance, because it's something that is this image of perfection, at some point, we're going to fail to uphold that image. And when that happens, what we do in order to continue to gain the same approval is we become deceptive. We lie. We don't show this is who I really am. And so what happened in that story with Sharon was I had a moment where I felt like, okay, I can either keep up the appearance of I am good and well and everything is fine and I'm sticking to my commitment, or I can be honest and share that, yeah, I had this and it's going to shatter this image and it's going to lead to a hard conversation.
Yep.
You're probably going to be really upset. And in that moment, my instinct was to keep up that appearance.
Yeah.
right? To lie and to keep up that appearance. And so that's what I did. But just as quickly as I did that, I realized, why did I just default to lying, to keeping up the appearances? And it was because of that drive for approval, that drive for, let me keep up the appearance. And so I think when it comes to that question of, you know, loving and secrecy or hiding someone, I genuinely think it begins in a place of a desire of, I want them to know that I'm a safe place for them, that they can share things with me, that I will protect them and I'll care for them. The point at which it becomes a genuine problem is when that secrecy now becomes a place for a sin to thrive and grow. Right. I think that there's a place for privacy when we're healing, a place where out of the public eye, we can begin to heal from some pain and brokenness. But secrecy allows for that sin to thrive and grow. And so I think we've got to be aware of, when is it secrecy and when is it privacy? When are we actually hurting them and enabling them by, you know, keeping this secret? And when is it actually really loving to do the hard thing and say, we need to bring some others into this. Some others need to know you need to get some help, that kind of thing.
That's really, really good and a great point. And I actually have a good book for that, because in God Knows, there is a whole section on the difference between privacy and secrecy. Mm. And it is really important to know the difference. And one of the things I talk about in there is one of the ways you know the difference between privacy and secrecy is in the motive. Why are you keeping something? Is it with the motive to have your own private thoughts? And we are entitled to our privacy, which is for the good of not only ourselves, but for the good of others. There are things that we are to keep private. Mm-hmm. Secrecy is to avoid accountability and to avoid hard conversations. And so that's a way that you know is in that sort of motive, that core motivation as to why one thing or the other. It's a pretty easy way to be able to tell the difference there. But I think one of the things that you said is really key, which is just sort of in that moment to take that quick assessment of, you know, why am I actually defaulting here? Because I think sometimes, particularly in the area of lying, particularly in the area of deception, it comes easy to us sometimes because we are used to it, because we have created a habit for ourselves in the attempt to, quote unquote, keep someone from something hard, because we love them. We don't want to tell them something hard because, that truth will shatter them. I can't do that. I love them too much. You know, I'm sure that in somewhere in the back of your noble mind, you were thinking, oh, I want to keep this from Sharon because I don't want to hurt her, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we say to ourselves. But in reality, you didn't want to face the wrath of something. You didn't want to face a hard conversation. And I think in leadership, especially, but this is for everyone, but I think in leadership, one of the things that we don't want to do as leaders is have that hard conversation. Yeah. And it is the reason why so much unhealth goes on in our churches as ministry leaders. We just don't want to have it. I mean, I will tell about the middle of the year, I was in a place where I was facing imminent burnout. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons was there was a very difficult conversation I needed to have, and I was avoiding it at all costs. Absolutely. And I'm a person that typically doesn't avoid hard things. But even me, I didn't want to have it, because who wants to disappoint someone? Who wants to have a tough conversation? Nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to let somebody down. Nobody wants to have a tough conversation. Nobody wants to hurt anybody. But the reality is we've got to be honest with ourselves. It is not love to lie on any level. It's just not.
Yeah.
It's not love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to be able to say too, I think in those moments, the secrecy piece also being, am I keeping this a secret so that I can help them keep up this appearance?
Yes.
Right.
That's good.
And how do I ensure they're keeping up that appearance? Because I don't want them to lose that, or I feel manipulated into, I've got to help them do this versus this is an appearance they need to let go of, but they need to heal some. And I'm going to help, you know, them do that out of the public eye. But yeah, that, how do I help somebody else keep up an image, I think is a huge part of the lying and secrecy.
Huge piece. And it is not love. I thought this was so interesting. You say that a lot of children of dysfunctional families become hopeless romantics. I love that you added this in your book, Ike Miller. This is interesting. So what is the difference between a hopeless romantic and a healthy romantic? Because it's good to be romantic, right? I mean, Sharon is absolutely not going to like it if you're not romantic at all.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. The part of the reason I put this in there is Sharon tells this funny story where I am very romantic. I love doing big romantic gestures. I love like making her feel special, like all of this. And Sharon tells this story of how she just, you know, for a long time, she just thought like, man, Ike is really in love with me. Like he is crazy in love with me.
Which is true. I can hear her saying this. I can hear it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's true. But then she had this moment where she realized like, but some of that is you're just really romantic. Like you'd love doing big romantic gestures. It's not just like you're crazy in love with me.
Yeah.
So I love all of that stuff. And so the reason that I included that and the reason we become these hopeless romantics is a part of it is we saw the moments as children where the big romantic gesture, the desire, the intentionality to change, to say, I'm going to change. I'm going to become the kind of husband I need to be, the kind of wife I need to be. We saw moments where that would have changed everything and it didn't happen. Mm. And we're like, man, I'm going to do that differently. I'm going to be the one who makes the commitment to be the father who's there. I'm going to be the wife who stays in it. I'm going to, you know, and so I kind of give a breakdown of, you know, the hopeless romantic, because there are parts of that that are unhealthy, that are problematic. Some of the things that I list there are you fall hard and fast into relationships without any real like consideration of, is this a good relationship? Is this healthy? You ignore red flags. You know, if there's some red flags of like, maybe this is, you know, you just blow right past those.
Yeah.
You spend all your time with this new relationship. Your friends go out the window, like you are all in on those friendships. You believe that at the end of the day, love is worth it all. Like there is nothing more important than the feeling of feeling love. Those are some of the red flags or some of the indications of a hopeless romantic. Whereas a healthy romantic, you can fall hard, but wisdom still has a hand on the wheel. There's still like the, okay, yes, I have strong feelings for this person, but I still need to be mindful of, you know, based on my, this is something that Andy Stanley says, and I put this in the book, but, you know, based on my past experience, my present circumstances, and my future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing to do? You still ask that question about the relationship. Is this a wise thing for me to enter this relationship? You pay attention to red flags. If somebody is like constantly trying to get you away from your friends to hang out with them, maybe that should be some indication that they're trying to isolate you. Mm. You know, if they are subtly manipulating you in ways, like you're aware of that. And there's also a sense of recognizing that relationships, it's an important relationship, but it's not all of a sudden your only relationship. Mm. And you're able to have some balance on those things. You recognize that the communication is important. It's not just how do they make me feel? Do I feel loved? Well, they may make you feel loved, but are they vulnerable with you? Do they communicate with you? Do they share what's going on in their world? Do you feel safe with them? You know, and so a healthy romantic still does the big romantic gesture, still wants the emotional intensity of that, but doesn't throw everything out the window for that.
Mm, so good. I'm telling you, this book is packed. It's packed full of really, really awesome helps. And it is just, it's a hopeful message, I think, for anyone who does have a really difficult past, but also people who just grew up with the regular hard things. And I think regardless, it will give you a lot of insight into this is why I react in a certain way in my work, in my marriage, in my relationships. And I'm telling you, there's something in this book for everyone. And I don't say that often, as you know, if you listen to this show, you know that this is pretty high praise, but I'm really fond of this book. It's a very, very good, well thought out, really, really good message. I endorsed it with bells on, and I really mean it. It's one to get good baggage. Really, really good by Ike Miller. Ike, I have one last question, and I ask it of every single guest. So I want to ask you, the show is called Jesus Over Everything. What is the last thing that you would say about Jesus if you could only say one more thing?
I would say we talk a lot about Jesus as the manifestation of God's love for us. And that is true. But I think what our world needs to know and we need to recover a sense for is that Jesus also came to remind us what kind of humans we were created to be. Mm. And that being so freeing for us because Jesus did the kind of work to be at peace with himself and with others. He did the work to have satisfaction in his Father. And that doesn't mean life was always easy or that things went well. But I think he lived with a kind of peace that we are all so desperate for.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Jesus Over Everything with Lisa Whittle. I'd love to come speak to your church or your organization in your city. All the information about my speaking dates and the quickest way to put in a request or reach me is at lisawhittle.com/speaking.